Welcome to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. I'm Ben Reed, and tonight we are beginning Jonathan Johnson's new memoir, The Desk on the Sea. Jonathan is one of Spokane's own, a poet and professor at Eastern Washington University, where he teaches as part of the MFA program for creative writing. This memoir, written during his sabbatical in Scotland, may not be a poem in form, but is an elegy just the same. The narrative alternates between excerpts from Jonathan's journal during the final week of his mother's life and recollections of his time with his family in Scotland. Here is The Desk on the Sea, read by the author, Jonathan Johnson.
The Desk on the Sea by Jonathan Johnson. The book begins with an epigraph by Ted Kooser from his poem, Mother. Were it not for the way you taught me to look at the world, to see the life at play in everything, I would have to be lonely forever. Prologue. The mountains or the sea? I'd come to Scotland to answer that question. Though I was alone, the answer I sought wasn't just for myself, but for all three of us, my family. The choice loomed large in my mind, like the sea and the mountains themselves. Daydreams of the country's landscape and us in it had sustained me through the most difficult period of my life. Now I was finally there, scouting in advance of our move for a year. A year in which I planned to find, what? Freedom? A new beginning? My best self? I didn't know. I only knew to look in Scotland. My imagination had been claimed and revived by a mysterious yearning, a compulsion even, to live there. But where exactly? And where would my wife Amy and our daughter Anya find whatever they might be seeking? This was going to be their year, too, and they had trusted me to choose for them. At the Edinburgh airport, the economy car I'd reserved was sold out. "But you'll be happy enough," the purple-haired, skinny young man behind the counter told me as he typed and looked at his screen. And sure enough, the replacement car was exquisite. A black Saab 90 with 15 miles on the odometer. I'd never driven anything so lavish. Even if we could have afforded it, which we most certainly couldn't, I would never have spent the extra for such a luxury. We'd scrupulously squirreled away every dollar we could spare for the coming year. It was my first bit of luck in Scotland. It gave me hope for more to come. The car drove like an arrow through long and tight parabolas of narrow roads as I followed a Michelin map the size of a bedsheet on the seat beside me from one village circled in red marker to the next. For months, that map had been tacked up on our dining room wall back home. Whenever our search online had led us to a cottage that seemed a likely candidate, something in a small village with a little school and trails leading out across the landscape, Amy and I had let Anya, who was almost eight, draw a red circle. In my first daydreams of Scotland, I had imagined us in the highlands, among steep glens and summits where the sheep were specks high on the slopes into which we would hike. Anya had needed to reach up to circle the northern villages on our map. But those mountainous places were remote, Amy had reminded me. We wouldn't get to know the country's bigger cities and towns much, and most of the highland villages where we found cottages to let were on lochs, not the coast. Amy's a native coastal dweller. Home for her has always meant the craggy shore and cove beaches around Marquette, her little upper Michigan city. There, Lake Superior is like a freshwater sea, the world's largest, stretching to the northern horizon across which the gold lights of iron ore ships pass at night. Waves boom up against the cliffs in the fall, sending spray into the forest, glazing the branches with ice. Marquette is also where my parents settled and I spent the latter years of my own childhood. It's where Amy and I spoke our wedding vows, in a clifftop meadow above Superior. A Scottish friend in America had said that if we liked coastline, we should check out the string of little fishing villages south of St. Andrews. Online, we found a couple of fishermen's cottages there that we liked. Some had windows from which you could watch sunrise over the North Sea. Anya drew more red circles, these down and to the right on our map, closer to her eye level. To save money, we decided I'd make the scouting journey alone. I had a few days in May to find us the place into which we'd move in July. I brought a picture Anya had drawn, a little house with a door and two windows, three arched and snow-capped mountains behind, a straight line for the beach, and a squiggly line for waves in front. In big block letters I read each night when I put the drawing on whatever nightstand I'd be sleeping beside, she'd written, "Goodbye, Daddy. I love you. Get a good house." So, the mountains or the sea? The question had seemed so important at the time. Which reality would we give ourselves to step into and make a life for a while? I drove that black Saab fast, by American, if not Scottish standards, between appointments with landlords. Each village we had imagined came into view. The mountains were higher and darker, the sea vaster. But there was another question pushing me on, I now realize, a question I had yet to articulate to myself. Was I moving to Scotland to mourn or rejoice? In the 4 years since the death of my mother, sorrow had become for me a daily way of life. The world had been empty of the one person I believed knew it best, knew me best. Everything she'd ever thought and seen and felt, every bit of wisdom, every memory in every neuron in that vast galaxy of neurons of her was gone. Nowhere. A few ashes in Lake Superior, sinking, floating out. And yet, through those same 4 years, she'd been everywhere. In the overflying geese I addressed with, "Hi, Mom." In the bright anticipation on faces here and there in each new poetry class I taught. Most of all, in my family. In the husband I wanted to be for Amy. In the parent I wanted, more than I'd ever wanted anything, to be for Anya. My mother continued filling me with capacity and gratitude. I could hear her voice. Look, notice, love. It was a false choice, of course, grief or wonder. Even before my mom died, when I knew it was coming, I had understood intellectually that grief and wonder must go on together, the twin poles of what would be my new motherless existence as my mother's son. But how? Parents die. It's the natural order of things. I was desolate, but for 4 years I endured, as people do. I had my work, writing and teaching. I had a house, bills, emails. I had my new obsession, Scotland, getting closer. All the while, though, sorrow and joy were at war, each determined to claim me, to be the one truth of my existence. The person who had given me my life and taught me to live it was gone. No. She was giving me my life still, still teaching me to live it. No, she, the person herself, was no more. And so on the battles went, through the days into years. I wept alone in the car a lot. I sang with the windows down. I knew that the reconciliation of life and death, of grief and wonder, is the great story of the human spirit. I knew it from John Keats and Mozart, both of whom my mother had given me. I knew it from my mother herself, but I couldn't feel it, not in the way I would need to feel it if I were going to pass on to my own child my mother's grace for living in that great paradox. Maybe in Scotland I could learn. Scotland would be away from the normalcy that had merely sustained me, my job and house and emails. And though I had not yet understood why, the beauty and truth of the Scotland I sought, whether in the mountains or beside the sea, would be inseparably somber and ecstatic, like the life for which I was also looking. Dr. Leslie Spry of the National Kidney Foundation writes, "Patients who have been on dialysis for at least 6 months and who decide to stop dialysis generally live an average of 10 days." Pocket Journal Entry, Marquette, Day 1, February 2nd. "I saw the geese," my mother said. "I think I saw the geese." Earlier, I talked on the phone with Kaczynski. He said he's seen a lot of bad stuff, but he's never seen a patient suffer more. His gut says it's over. We're in uncharted territory. He's done hundreds of legs and three or four hands, but never both hands. He said he'd do it, go home after and have dinner and go to bed. But is it something we ought to do? He's seen her slide these last 3 weeks. She was always headed this way. I tried to let you know that somewhat when you were talking about giving her your kidney. The question even then was, how much would you be giving? Kaczynski also said my mother would never have seen Anya born if not for my dad. Earlier, when my dad was leaving to teach, my mom, drowsy with ache and morphine, said, "There goes the one and only. Always. Always." When we visited at Christmas, I cut a tree for the house. She was having difficulty eating. Her remaining fingers were paining her. Amy helped, and my mom said she was grateful. She said she was grateful to have people who love me and are so patient with me. She said, "I should build a monument to your father in the front yard for all he does." After she found out about her hands, that they couldn't be saved, my mother sat in front of her kitchen window and said, "I saw the geese. I think I saw the geese." It was snowing heavily outside. It was the depth of winter. 4 years later. Scotland, midsummer. Amy and Anya and I have found a little patch of sand on an otherwise rocky stretch of coast beside a ruined cottage. The sand is damp from this morning's shower, but it's warm under the afternoon sun. As an 8-year-old, Anya lives about half her waking life in her imagination. Her interactions with Amy and me are often in character as Harry Potter. Amy is Hermione and I'm Ron Weasley. About half the time, our family goes through the world as these three young friends out for a grand adventure. Today, the trio is shipwrecked. Our protagonist, Harry, the little girl with long blonde hair and scarless skin on her forehead, is fixing something to eat, which delights Ron, who is perpetually hungry. Anya digs a little bowl in the sand into which she drops the kelp she collects. "But Ron doesn't know it yet, Daddy. He's just hungry for lunch?" "Right, and Harry is fixing it for him." The breeze off the North Sea is cool. It moves through our hair and up the grass and through the thistles and empty windows and absent roof of the ruined cottage. Anya walks out onto the rocks. She is confident on her bare feet. Her cuffs are rolled and dry. I curl my toes in the damp, warm sand. Amy sits beside me, turning the lens of her camera and taking pictures. The camera gives a little click with each image, and I can see what Amy sees. Anya lifting her arms out to her sides for balance and looking down to search for the next deliciously slimy, long strand of kelp for Ron's castaway soup. Anya hopping off the rocks and back on the sand, her gold hair lifted with her descent, a few strands blown across her face. "I'm hungry, Harry." "Honestly, Ronald," Hermione chimes in, "Harry's fixing us something as fast as he can." Amy makes a good Hermione. Same curly dark hair, the same pleasure in feigning exasperation and eye-rolling aloofness over her loyalty and deep affection. "Beef stew, Harry?" I ask. "With sausages, I hope." Anya smiles in spite of herself. "Just wait, Ron." She mixes the kelp and sand around a bit, carries it back to the rock, and lays it out in three piles. "Okay, it's ready." Amy lifts the kelp to her chin. "Mmm, thanks, Harry." "What the bloody hell is this, Harry?" I demand. "Lunch, Ron." "I'd rather starve." "You could have a cow pie." 5 cows graze just upshore from the ruined cottage. "And Daddy, Ron only hears the word pie, okay?" "Pie, wonderful, Harry." Our cottage is in the village around the point, a 1/2 mile down shore. We moved in 6 days ago. For a year, Anya will go to school and search the rock pools at low tide for shells and little creatures and likely develop something of a real Scottish accent. Amy will take photos and shop with delight at the village greengrocer and cook slow meals. I'll write poems upstairs in our bedroom at the drop leaf table we've put against the window. When a ship passes, if I happen to glance up and notice, I'll look in the little telescope to see if I can spot the flag. We will live a story of our own invention. But it will be a story without the audience to whom it would have meant the most. Beside the telescope, on the polished, worn wood table, is a porcelain creamer I use as a vase for a single thistle and one seagull feather. These I found on the point 2 or 3 evenings ago. We'd settled in and finished unpacking, and I'd left for my first walk by myself. In my pocket was one of 2 tiny green pebbles I'd brought from the cove on Lake Superior, where we'd scattered my mother's ashes. I had in mind to place the pebble on the water's edge, where the waves break, so that at night in bed I could imagine I heard my mother's voice in the breath of the surf. Instead, I picked the thistle, took the feather from where it lay beside the grassy path. So the pebble sits there when I write along with its twin, the one I brought to set beside a certain narrow highland lock from which mountain slope rises steep on both sides. I'd seen Loch Sheil on a map, pronounced the same as my mother's name, Sheila, just 1 vowel shorter. She never got to Scotland, and I don't yet know if any of her people, the McClures, were from the highlands, but that long, narrow lock is where the other pebble from her Lake Superior cove, her grave, will go, if I ever let them go. Meanwhile, they are good company, the 2 little stones. They are nothing like the bright emerald of my mother's eyes, but they remind me to think of that green. And then I'm recalling her freckled face exactly, the face of the one whose love followed me wherever I went. And then I am without her again, a son who has lost his mother. It's become clear to Ron that the pies are not what he'd had in mind, so he's back at his pile of seaweed. All right, Harry, here goes. Ron gulps and makes his pained, apprehensive face. I hold the kelp up to my mouth, bend over and make deep hurling sounds, and then I'm on my hands and knees, retching and coughing. I know the exact curve of Anya's smile without looking up. I couldn't tell you how many amputations my mother had. Toes and then foot. Shin and more shin bone. More toes and fingers. Knuckle to nothing. The other foot, thumb. I've lost count. Through all this, her surgeon, Dr. Kaczynski, became her friend, and in turn a family friend, just Kaczynski, the way you'd call an old troublemaker buddy by his last name. At her funeral, which was a kind of wake at my parents' house, he stood with a drink in his hand and said, for the second time, that he'd never seen anyone suffer as she'd suffered. Kaczynski wasn't a young man. He'd had maybe 30 years of practice by that night. I can't imagine what he'd seen, what torments he'd witnessed to compare to hers. Her final choice had been between losing her hands, what was left of them, and bringing it all to an end, the kidney dialysis, the frostbite-like scalding and blackening of her remaining fingers, the open sore where her left leg ended just below the knee, the narcotic nausea. She had endured years of all this, and worse, because she wanted to be here, because she loved us and loved every day, because she could sit at the kitchen table and wave goodbye with both hands as her loved ones backed out the driveway and into the wider world. "I have a good life," my mother said many times over the years, planting her emphasis on good so deep and solid in my memory I can hear her clearly now. A good life, with an emphasis that spoke of a satisfied heart. "We don't get the days back," she also used to say. When she still had one leg, she sat in the sun in her wheelchair. Anya, who was then about 2, sat in her lap, and my mother pushed them backward with her remaining foot up a ramp I'd recently built to go from the backyard up to the deck. At the top, she told Anya to hold on, lifted the foot, and with her only grandchild, raised her arms and exclaimed, "Wee!" all the way down to the bottom. My mother made Amy, sitting on the grass watching, promise not to tell my father. It was a shallow ramp and not long, but my father was the watcher and nurse of my mother's open wounds, the one who would have no doubt imagined most vividly what a fall could mean. Anya craned her head around to look at my mom in the face and declared, "Again, Nana!" And my mother leaned to touch her forehead to my daughter's and called her my little sprite and agreed to 1 more and back them up the ramp again. Amy kept her promise not to tell my father until my mother's funeral, when she told the story to the smiles and laughs of everyone crowded into my parents' living room, including my father. "She made the right choice," Kaczynski was saying to me a short time later as he swished the ice in his drink. He repeated more of what he'd told me on the phone before she died. I'd have cut off her hands, gone home, had dinner and a drink, and gone to bed. Blue-eyed and burly, fair-skinned as my mom, Kaczynski has a gift for bluntness. One of the things my mom, diplomatic though she was herself, liked about him. But it wouldn't have been good. He shook his head. The shock and pain would have been far worse than with her feet. She didn't have anything left to go through that. If she'd have survived a few months, I'd have been surprised. Of her cluster of diseases, all that's worth saying is there were the kinds of things people get. Some old heart damage, a treated liver disorder, diabetes combined with a not uncommon small vessel and nerve condition called Raynaud's, and a related autoimmune condition called Crest's scleroderma. Nothing particularly exotic, no keywords of dread. But together, the diabetes, Raynaud's, and scleroderma slowly took her extremities after years of allowing in occasional infections, the antibiotics from which finally destroyed her kidneys. When her palms and the few remaining nubs of her fingers turned purple and white and black, and Kaczynski said that all that was left to do was to take everything to just below both elbows, and he admitted there wasn't much chance she'd outlast the operation by long, and the thrush in her mouth made it painful to talk, and the sores on her back and tailbone were raw to the flesh, and she was buried down under so many narcotics that it took great effort to climb to the surface and open her eyes and smile and say hello, she let go. There was so much to let go. While her body was being periodically carved away, and more hours of her days were spent on the business of surviving, her life had kept growing. Movies, cappuccino with my father in the parked car overlooking Lake Superior, her peonies and daylilies blooming. In the last few years, when this or that finger was withered and bandaged, and she could no longer dig in the dirt, I dug for her while she sat in her chair and supervised. And so much of Anya. Anya, her little sprite, running naked out into the backyard. Anya propped up in bed beside her in the morning, both of them drinking from cups with spill-proof lids and big handles. And in February 4 years ago, on one of those few days my mother was told she'd have left to live when she stopped going to dialysis, Anya turning, her arms stretched above her head, turning her pirouette from dance class for my mother, who raised her head and lifted the unimaginable weight of her eyelids to see. But the hardest thing for my mother about losing my daughter, I would guess, wasn't the reality of never seeing her again. Impossibly hard as that must have been, that bright little face fading away with everything else. From what I know of my mother, what was hardest about losing Anya was that there would be no more days to teach her. Some of how Anya will feel about her life has, I suppose, been settled at 8 years old. But much of the quality of her relationship to her life still remains an open question, I know. As her father, I also know there's only so much I can do to affect what comes her way in that life. I'll take her to beautiful places like this Scottish coast. I'll teach her to be good to her body and spirit, to tend to herself and surroundings with attentiveness. But precious little of what will be the tangible world for Anya is up to me, or her. The lesson my mother taught my daughter in the days they had together was not how to change the world. The lesson my mother taught, and the lesson I must keep teaching for her, the lesson I am determined she'll keep teaching through me, the lesson I hope to leave behind as my legacy too someday, is how to be at home in the world. Orphaned at 17, growing up to live what now seems so few healthy years, then for years enduring a body that slowly died from the extremities inward, my mother loved to hold leaves in her hand. She loved the way seagulls walked, the voices of geese passing low, the opportunity to speak kind words to someone for whom kind words may have been rare. What I get from being Anya's father and my mother's son, the specific purpose the two of them together give my life, is a duty to look on every day as an opportunity for love. You can teach only what you know, and it is perhaps through teaching that you come to know something deepest in your soul. My mother let go. She decided it was time to be done, that she must leave the teaching of Anya to me and to Amy, as she must leave everything else. How are we going to tell the kids? She asked my father. You stop dialysis, you get a week to live, maybe a few days more. I arrived home after my younger sister, Anne. Amy and Anya came in on a flight 2 days behind mine. Through those last days, I wrote what happened in my little pocket journal, finding the moment's beauty and lessons as well as their pain, looking for my way forward. Like the logbook of a sinking ship, something to take when the lifeboat drifts away. Much like I am writing now. For each of our ships is always sinking. All of our love's lifeboats are always waiting to cast off. No one gets much objectivity about his loves, but we get stories. Here's one of mine from a year or two before my mother's last week. I'm sitting in a bread and donut shop in Marquette, Michigan, my parents' adopted hometown and the home to which I typically migrate twice a year. I'm writing and watching the traffic. In the booth behind me are three elderly ladies and one woman in her 50s, about my mom's age. They are talking about living fully, appreciating what they have, the sort of everyday wisdom you sometimes overhear in conversations among older folks and less old folks. The 50-somethings got a vaguely familiar voice, but I didn't get a look at her face when they came in and passed me earlier. She's talking about a woman she knows who is an example of living fully, of appreciating what one has, who lives with a wisdom upon which they've all agreed. Poor thing, I overhear. She's had both her feet cut off. She has two or three fingers wrapped in gauze, and she comes through the drive-thru a couple times a week with her husband. She gets a cappuccino, and they split a big cookie. And she's always so sweet, so glad to see me, always asks how I am. I place the woman speaking as Diane, the day manager at Hardee's. My parents went there for years to grade their students' papers and tell my mom's troubles, after which they became regulars at the drive-thru. Always so sweet, so glad to see me. I can hear those words still, coming from the booth behind me then, from somewhere inside me now. Always asks how I am. I have carried this story with me like the two green pebbles on my desk. Every so often I tell it to myself for confirmation of what I knew of my mother's spirit, for what it says about the countless quiet ways her spirit spread through the world. When I overheard Diane, I thought about my parents down at Lake Superior a few minutes after chatting with her at the drive-thru. They would have parked overlooking the beach and talked easily and slow to each other. My mother would have watched the seagulls turn in the breeze and wished them well. "Hello there," my mother would have said if one of the seagulls walked up to her door and studied her, first with one eye and then the other. "We'll bring bread next time. I don't think a cookie would be good for your tummy." One eye at a time, the seagulls on this north coast turn their heads in just the same way to watch Amy, Anya, and me. Beside the beach where we play, the shadow of the roofless, ruined cottage is getting long across the grass, which elsewhere shines in the tilting gold sunlight. Gloaming, they call that light here, and as far north as we are, it will last long into the night, as twilights do all summer in Scotland. "Time to get back to the castle, you two," Hermione instructs. At 40, I finally know my life's goal. It's been there for years, but it's just lately that I've come to realize it is my deepest identity and purpose. My life's goal is to live as Anya's father, as Amy's husband, as a poet and friend and human, in a way befitting the title, Sheila Johnson's son.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. Join us next time to continue Jonathan Johnson's memoir, The Desk on the Sea. Music for this episode is by Caerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.